The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Hi, this is a special edition of the Hugh Hewitt Show. Dr. Anthony Fauci joined me a year ago on March 17th, 2020. He returned today on March 21st, 2021. Let's listen to his most recent interview, and then back to back, let's listen to Tony Fauci a year ago on the Hugh Hewitt Show. Welcome back, America. It's Hugh Hewitt. Thank you for listening to the Hugh Hewitt Show today. I'm glad to welcome back Dr. Tony Fauci. Good morning, Dr. Fauci. How are you?
Good morning, Hugh. How you doing?
I'm great. I want to dive first into the science, doctor. Variants. When will you expect to reach stability with the virus, meaning that you are sure it cannot evolve into something more deadly or more contagious or more evasive than the current vaccines can cope with?
You know, Hugh, you'll never reach that as long as there's virus circulating in the community. Viruses don't mutate unless they replicate. If you prevent their replication by suppressing the spread in the community, at that point, you'll reach the area where you're talking about, where it's not going to change any. But as long as there's, like right now, we have in our own country about 50,000 new infections each day. With that much viral dynamics going on, there's always the threat and the reality of the evolution of variants. So the best way to stop this is to just suppress the virus to a very, very low level.
Now, doctor, I don't think people talk about worst case scenarios much, probably because there's not much upside in scaring people, but I believe in transparency. The book, The Great Influenza, pointed out to me, and I didn't know this, that the 1918 influenza went through 12 iterations in the summer of 18, but it actually got started in 17. When will we be, do you think we'll be past a danger point in the virus's ability to go very bad for very many people?
Yeah, great question, Hugh. And that's the reason why we often say a global pandemic requires a global response, because even if we, and I believe we will, within a quite a reasonable period of time, suppress the virus in this country and in places in the developed world, the European Union, Canada, Australia, et cetera, where there's the resources to vaccinate essentially the entire population, then you could get good suppression and feel comfortable. However, as long as there's virus replicating in a robust way anywhere in the world, there's always the danger that mutants and variants will evolve and ultimately get back to whatever country successfully suppressed it. So that's the reason why you're hearing a lot about a global effort to suppress this, because we've got to suppress it throughout the entire world. Because if you're doing fine in this country, and then there are regions of the world where there's outbreaks, the virus is going to continue to mutate. And ultimately, because of the extraordinary extensive travel we have throughout the world, it's ultimately going to get back to the countries that suppressed it. So that's the reason why we should have a commitment, and we do, through a number of mechanisms, including COVAX, to make sure that virtually all the countries in the world will have the capability of suppressing it.
So, Dr. Fauci, what happened in 1918 when it eventually went away, even though we didn't have the vaccine? We never got a vaccine for 1918. But it eventually faded away, even though it circulated around the world. What happened there that we can't rely on happening here?
Well, the only trouble with that, Hugh, is that it killed between 50 and 100 million people worldwide in a population that was one third the size of the global population now, which means that would be equivalent to killing between 150 and 300 million people. So when you just ravage the world like that, after a while, you run out of susceptible host, you get herd immunity, and that's it. We don't want to go there. We want to stop it before it does that kind of devastation. which is the reason why the answer is the proper implementation of vaccines.
So, doctor, is it still a possibility that such a ravaging could occur? I believe it is, but I'm not a scientist. I just talked to my official toxicologist, who's a relative, who says, you can't rule it out. I don't know if it's 5 or 10%, but you can't rule it out. Can you rule it out?
You know, you never could rule those things out, but the likelihood of that happening is extraordinarily low, given the fact that we have multiple highly efficacious vaccines. So, I mean, right now, for example, you know, we've vaccinated completely about 14% of the population, and even maybe 24% have at least one dose. By the time we get into the late spring and early summer, we're going to have a lot more people vaccinated. So I think the likelihood of the scenario that you're pointing out, Hugh, is going to be extremely unlikely.
Good. Is there any evidence that it's become, any of the variants that we know of yet, have become more dangerous for children than the original or the variants?
You know, there is a suggestion that one of them is easily infecting children, which means, you know, children still, on the whole, do much, much better than adults. If you look at the rate of hospitalization per 100,000 people, and you look at those charts, children are way, way off on the side of the chart where there's very little hospitalization. But some of the variants, if they have the capability of infecting children more readily, you're ultimately going to see more serious disease in children.
Now, doctor, I asked a few of my friends, I said, Dr. Fauci's coming back on Monday. What are your best questions? Great question from a friend who had been part of the thousands of Americans who stepped forward for the trials, did the Moderna trial, got successfully vaccinated. He is wondering, when does he have to get revaccinated? When does the trial people were first in line, they're 6 months into it. Do you have any idea yet when they've got to get a booster shot?
You know, no, we don't. And that's the reason why we observe people for up to 2 years or even longer following vaccination. Right now, we know things look good at least up to 6 months and likely much longer. But the only way you know is you've got to follow people and find out when that level of antibody falls below a certain level and people start getting infected again. So that's one of the things you only learn by observation, Hugh.
And is the effort in place to observe enough people to come to a reliable conclusion, doctor? Okay. Emily Oster, an economist at Brown, wrote a piece in The Atlantic last week, which you probably read, Dr. Fauci. You read everything. The science on transmission by the vaccinated is still hazy. I received my second dose on Saturday. Can I transmit the virus?
Well, you know, whoever asked that question, is it's a good question. Right now, we haven't ruled out completely that even though you are, and I'm like you, Hugh, I'm vaccinated also, about whether or not if we get exposed, we could get infected and have no symptoms because we're vaccinated. And if there's enough virus in our nasopharynx, theoretically, we could infect someone else, which is the reason why we ask people to continue to wear masks. Having said that, as the weeks and months go by, more and more papers are coming out saying that the likelihood of transmitting from a vaccinated person gets lower and lower because some studies are looking at the level of virus in the nasopharynx, and it's either absent or very, very low. I would predict, though you just got to be careful with predictions, that after several more months, Hugh, we're going to get enough data to say that the likelihood of transmitting an infection from an asymptomatic vaccinated person is extremely low.
That will be good news. Now, I want to talk. My toxicologist asked me to ask you about therapies other than vaccine, pointing out that Lilly has a combo therapy that's been approved for reuse. Regeneron has a cocktail that reduces the viral load, the time to alleviate symptoms. Do you think that we're selling those therapies hard enough for the anti-vaxxer crowd and for people generally to know about, that they can ask them and then they are available enough to even tell people about them?
You know, the answer is there's not a big supply of them, number one. Number two, one of the constraints of that approach, Hugh, is that it's got to be given intravenously, which means you got to have an infusion center or get somebody into a clinic or a hospital. That has been the logistic reason why it has not been widely used. The other thing we know from the clinical trials is that if you wait a bit until the disease progresses somewhat, the monoclonal antibodies don't work very well at all. They work really well if you get people early. And early means symptoms that are not yet severe enough to get you into the hospital. Once you get advanced symptomatology requiring hospital intervention, the likelihood of a monoclonal antibody being effective is less than when you give it early in the course of disease.
Let me set this next question up neutrally, because I have been deluged with information about ivermectin. I was, in fact, prescribed ivermectin a few months ago by my internist, who has been my internist for 20 years when I was exposed, quite definitely. I didn't develop it. Doesn't mean that the ivermectin worked. What's your opinion, Dr. Fauci?
The answer is, we don't know. I mean, there have been a number of studies that have not really been well done in the sense of the classical randomized placebo-controlled trial. So that question is still open. We don't know the answer to that. Some studies now are looking at it to determine if it is. You know, we used to think people were claiming that colchicine worked also. There have been a couple of studies now that I think have closed the book on that, that it looks like it doesn't. But I think the situation with ivermectin, still no evidence that I'm convinced that it works. But again, not any evidence to convince that it doesn't work. So studies are still going on.
And my doctor said, we know it can't hurt you. Is that your opinion as well? So
I mean, it's a drug that has very few serious toxicities.
All right. Do you trust the Russian and or the Chinese vaccine to be efficacious?
You know, I'm assuming that they are. I mean, certainly the data on the Russian vaccine, I've taken a look at some of the reports. It looks pretty good. The Chinese one very well might be good. I haven't had the opportunity to examine the data to the extent that I would feel comfortable. But the Russian one, I believe, is quite effective.
Well, that's interesting. Now, the Wall Street Journal on Friday, Doctor, reported that China resisted international pressure for an investigation it saw as an attempt to assign blame, delayed the probe for months, secured veto rights over participants, and insisted its scope encompass other countries as well, the journal found. If the Chinese can exercise that kind of authority over the WHO, is the WHO efficacious for determining the origins?
Well, again, Hugh, a good question, and that's one of the reasons why when we went back into WHO, I had the opportunity, as you might recall, on the first day of President Biden's tenure as president, he had asked me to address the executive board of WHO and announce we're coming back in and we're going to resume our responsibilities regarding support. But one of the important points in my statement was that we were very serious about reforms of WHO. So we want to get back in. We feel that it is a necessary organization. The world needs a WHO, but they do need reforms. And the reforms relate to what you just said, that there cannot be undue influence by any country on decisions of WHO. It's got to be based purely on considerations of global health.
Now, I know you're not an international investigator, but from what you've read, do you believe that the People's Republic of China presently has undue influence over the WHO?
You know, I don't think as much as people are saying, Hugh. I mean, there's a big story. People talk about that. But I don't believe that that's the case. It may have been in the beginning, but I don't see that right now.
All right. A vaccine skeptic, another one of my colleagues, David Drucker of the Washington Examiner. A vaccine skeptic tells you, Dr. Fauci, quote, what's the point? Since you're saying I still have to wear a mask indefinitely and I can't immediately go back to living a normal life, what is the point of getting a vaccine?
Well, first of all, I have never said to you that you have to wear a mask indefinitely. I never said that. I said that after you're vaccinated, until we prove, apropos of your good question a few minutes ago, that there's no virus in a person's nasopharynx who's been vaccinated. Until then, that's why we're suggesting wearing a mask. I never said we should wear it indefinitely, for sure. And the reason you get vaccinated is to save your life because you may be in a situation. Yes. I mean, that's a really good reason.
Yeah, well, that's what I think, too. Why bother not harming? Now, you have a media strategy doctor, and I don't know who sets it up for you. Heavily weighted to the traditionally elite outlets. Meet the Press, of which I'm a member, and CBS and NBC. Have you appeared on Newsmax yet? Have you appeared on Dennis Prager's show? Do you avoid the places where there might be more contention, but also a different audience?
No, I don't, Hugh, at all. Seriously, I mean, I say yes to a wide variety of requests. I've been on Fox multiple times. I mean, so I don't shy away from that.
All right. Lessons from the pandemic that will prevent the next one. When you sit back and you start making the yellow pad notes on how do we prevent, you know, a 100-year event doesn't mean every 100 years. It means once 100 years. It could be next year. What do we do differently this time?
Well, there's a number of things. First of all, we've got to make sure that we have a good global health security network, that we are interconnected and very transparent in what goes on at any part of the world so that we can actually respond rapidly. Number two, we've got to bolster up our own local public health capability, which really over the years has been, you know, subject to attrition that really was unfortunate, maybe kind of victims of our own success because we've done so well over the years with vaccines and antibiotics. But the local public health response has not been optimal. And we knew that from the situation regarding how we were trying to do identification, isolation, and contact tracing. And we were not really that successful in doing that. The other thing, Hugh, is something that, you know, I know you've spoken, I've spoken about a fair amount. When you're having a common enemy like a virus, you cannot address that in the arena of divisiveness that we've had in this country. Not taking one side or the other, but when you have the kind of divisiveness that we've had in this country over the last year during the outbreak, that's made it very difficult to get a common, unified response against the virus. So, I mean, there are, like, again, there are a number of lessons. There are public health lessons. There are scientific lessons. And there are lessons of how we as a nation approach a common enemy, the virus, as opposed to fighting with each other.
And Dr. Fauci, apropos of that, I always tell people, everybody is doing the best that they can. And everybody makes mistakes. Do you agree with me on that?
Absolutely. Right. Yeah.
What is the most surprising thing about the disease scientifically? As you study it and you've been doing this your whole life, what surprised you about this disease?
Yeah. A characteristic of the disease, Hugh, that was unique, puzzling. And then when we really were found out about it, it really changed the approach that we took. And that is you have a disease that has the capability of already killing 535 or more thousand people in the United States, a deadly disease for people who are susceptible, the elderly and those with underlying conditions. At the same time, about 33% to 40% of the people have absolutely no symptoms. We've just never seen anything like that before. Usually when you have a disease that kills these many people, you may have a small fraction of people don't have symptoms, but not 40%. The other thing that has really puzzled us early on, but now we know it very clearly, is that between 50 and 60% of all the transmissions come from someone who has no symptoms. So you get infected from somebody who has no symptoms. Generally, when you have respiratory infections, historically, the outbreaks are driven by people who have symptoms. Occasionally, you get a small percentage of the transmissions are from people with no symptoms. But to have 50 to 60% of all the transmissions coming from someone without symptoms makes it very difficult to really appreciate the under the radar screen spread in the community. And that's where we really got hit badly, because that was going on in our country to a much greater extent before we really fully realized what was going on.
Dr. Fauci, why are obese people so susceptible? I understand heart disease, I understand, but I do not understand obesity.
You know, that's a great question. I think it's a couple of things. I think it's the mechanical movement of the diaphragm to expand and contract your lungs. And we know that because people do better when you put them prone as opposed to supine. So one of the things that obese people have, they don't have the capability of easily inhaling and exhaling because of the constraints on their plasticity of the lung. That's one of the things. The other thing I believe is that obese people, particularly morbidly obese people, have a much higher rate of the other underlying comorbidities which get a serious outcome. That's diabetes, hypertension, heart disease. The incidence in a morbidly obese person of those other diseases is much higher than the general population.
Ought we to have begun last year, ought we to begin now, an effort to get people to lose weight?
Yeah, I mean, obesity is an epidemic in this country, Hugh. I mean, that's really one of the unfortunate situations. And there are so many reasons for that, you know, that date back from the time a person is a child, the kind of diet that they get exposed to. That's something. And it's particularly disproportionate in certain demographic groups. I mean, African-American and Latinx population clearly almost certainly related to the lack of accessibility early on when they're children of a completely varied and healthy diet.
Okay, I'm wrapping up, doctor, because I don't want to take too much of your time. Sunk costs are an economic term. They are very hard for people to deal with. If you're studying the data, have you led to any conclusion on lockdowns? Because we have some states like California that went in hard for lockdowns. They're not doing any better. Indeed, they might be doing worse than Florida, which did not go in for lockdowns at all. So the sunk costs on lockdown are enormous and prevent people from dealing with it objectively. But you understand sunk costs. Did we make mistakes on lockdowns?
You know, Hugh, I don't think so. I think the lockdown situation is really very complicated because there have been some states that said they locked down. And when you look at the actual, you know, tracking them on GPSs about how much they locked down, it isn't nearly as much as was claimed. In fact, they did a comparison of the European lockdown versus the United States lockdown, and they did it by GPS. How many people go to the stores? How many people go to the parks? And when Europe locked down, they locked down a heck of a more strictly than we did.
And it has efficacy. You believe it worked?
Yes, it does. I mean, it has efficacy in suppressing the outbreak, but it also, as you say, and I agree, has significant economic consequences.
Time for a pause now in this edition of The Interview with Hugh Hewitt. I want to remind you that our sponsor is andrewandtodd.com. They're with Sierra Pacific. They lend you money to refinance your house or buy a home or help your son or daughter become investors in real estate by becoming a non-occupying co-borrower. They help senior citizens with reverse mortgage. They help veterans with no money down mortgages. They help you refinance. So if you need to get money out of your house or you need a whole new house, go to andrewandtodd.com or call them at 888-1172. Now back to this edition of Hugh Hewitt and The Interview. All right, two more questions. One's just a historical factor. A new book out by Josh Rogan suggests that in an early, a late January meeting, Pottinger and O'Brien wanted a shutdown of China inbound. You and Mnuchin were opposed to it. Is that correct?
No. I think that simplifies the discussion. So, I mean, I often get that, but people say, I said, no, don't do it. That's not the case. I had brought up the point, historically, when you're trying to shut down a country during an outbreak, sooner or later, it gets spread throughout the world and you shut down this country and it comes in from another country. I never said I was against shutting down. I was giving a caveat about being careful if you shut down. As a matter of fact, you may not get the total effect you want. When the president decided that he was going to shut down, I agreed with that at that point. I just gave a caveat about being careful when you do it. But as All of a sudden, the history has evolved. Everybody says, I was against shutting down. I wasn't. I was giving some cautionary warnings about it.
All right. My very last question is high science. It has to do with the Wuhan lab at which this is suspected of escaping. They were doing something called gain of function research. I know you know what that means. It took me a long time to get my lawyer arms around it. Did the NIH support gain of function research? It sounds very dangerous to me.
No, we don't. We have guidelines now that do not support that kind of research in those circumstances. We support some form of gain of function, which is appropriate. We did not support gain of function research there.
Do you think that had something to contribute to the escape? Do you believe in the escape from the lab theory?
No, I mean, I think that, I mean, obviously, you can never rule that out completely. I mean, it's just one of those things you can't. But the evidence that of the sequencing of the virus in bats makes it very, very unlikely. They were doing things that were interpreted as being gain of function that I don't think falled under the real strict category of that. But we years ago, Hugh, made a policy that in order to, before you support any gain of function, it's got to go through multiple reviews that go up to the Department of Health and Human Services. So years and years ago, we were supporting among our grantees, mostly in influenza, not in COVID-19, mostly in influenza. But then because of concerns, the constraints that are put on gain-of-function experiments are really rather stringent.
So an allegation was made that the NIAI had supported the Wuhan lab gain-of-function research. That's not true?
We supported by a subcontractor. We gave a grant to a person in the United States who subcontracted a collaboration with Wuhan, but that was not gain-of-function research.
Okay, very important to get that. Okay, I have time for one last question, Doctor. I'm now vaccinated. Can I go see my grandkids?
Yes. As long as your grandkids are healthy and don't have an underlying condition that would make them really seriously at risk if they got infected. If they're healthy young grandkids, you can go see them without a mask in their home. Have fun.
You made my day, Doctor. Thank you for your time. You're always generous. Keep doing the good work.
Thank you, Hugh. Always good to be with you.
Thank you. That was the second interview I've ever done with Tony Fauci. Dr. Fauci was my guest on Monday, March 22nd. That is now a year after he was my guest the first time on March 17th, 2020, a year ago. Let's listen to Tony Fauci on The Hugh Hewitt Show a year ago. Welcome back, America. I'm Hugh Hewitt. Thank you for listening. The Greeks had the Oracle of Delphi, and Americans have the Oracle of Fauci. And Dr. Anthony Fauci joins me now. Good morning, Doctor. How are you?
I'm well, thank you. How are you?
I am terrific. Thank you for all you're doing for the country. My wife, who we refer to as the Fetching Mrs. Hewitt here, wanted me to say you're a rock star, and everybody knows it.
Why, thank you.
I want to thank, by the way, your wife, Christine, your daughters, Jennifer, Megan, and Allison. They must be worried about you like my daughter's worried about me. Is that true?
That is correct. They really are. I was hoping that wouldn't be the case, but they really are.
Well, you're working hard. I mean, you're making a mockery of all of us who think we work hard in the 60s, but you're in your 70s. I have a question, though. My daughter, who I refer to as Rumpel, she who must be obeyed, is now telling me what I can and cannot do. Is that what you intended to do, to empower children to tell their parents what to do and not to do?
Well, you know, whatever it takes, really, to get things done in an appropriate manner. Very often, children, and my own children, I can say for sure, have a significant influence on your behavior. When they come in, they give you a new kind of reality test. So when they tell you to stay home or distance yourself from people and don't go to crowded places, you listen to them. If you sort of see it on TV or read about it or hear about it on the radio, it kind of goes by you without really hitting you. But when your children tell you, that's a different story.
Now, I want to drill down on seniors, my target audience. We got 6 million people listen to this show. The vast majority of them are between 45 and 64, but we got a lot of older people as well. A lot of grandparents, including me, all of my grandkids are under 9. This weekend, I was going to go drive and see them because my daughter's alone. My son-in-law is deployed, and there are 3 kids under 9. And she said to me yesterday, don't come. Is she right?
You know, she is. Right now, what we're trying to do, and, you know, yesterday at the White House Task Force press conference, we made an announcement to really ratchet up some of the guidelines for what we call physical and social distancing. And one of them is, if you have someone who is elderly, and particularly an elderly person with an underlying condition, such as heart disease and lung disease or diabetes, that puts them at an increased risk of getting the complications of coronavirus if, in fact, they get infected, you really want to protect those vulnerable people. So the guideline, as stringent as it sounds, I know is appropriate because it has worked in other settings, is to essentially have these individuals, the elderly, self-isolate in the home for at least the next 15 days to see what the direction of this outbreak is. And that means physical separation. Now, you don't want to make someone so socially lonely that their life is miserable, but you want to physically separate yourself from them, because a young person might go out into the community, get infected, and we know now from good experience with China, with South Korea, and now most recently with Italy and France, that younger individuals who get infected tend to do very well. Some of them have minimal symptoms as opposed to the chance of getting into trouble. So a young person may go out, get infected, and inadvertently come back, and by physical interaction with the elderly or those with compromised immune systems, might actually infect them. And then the consequences are much more severe than a younger person getting infected.
So, Dr. Fauci, I'm going to use myself as an example, and we'll expand from there. I'm 64. I'm in terrific shape. Just had my physical. Ran 7 miles on Kauai a week ago. In fact, the Spouting Horn. I know you run every day, 3.5 miles. I've got runner's back and a tear in a rotator cuff, but I'm in great shape. My grandkids are healthy. You would still tell me, don't go visit them.
No, you know, I would tell you the following, that in as a general guideline rule, you should not. But, you know, when you talk about the elderly, particularly if, as you say, you are otherwise really quite healthy, you know, there's a numerical age and there's a physiologic age. And some people who are 55, 60 are really kind of, you know, compromised because they don't age well. Whereas some people 75 and even 80 who are vigorous, athletic, and they do well. So when you get a guideline and have a cutoff and you say, well, if you're 70 years of age or older, there really needs to be some flexibility in interpreting that. I mean, if you want to be totally safe, then you overshoot and say, okay, I'm 60 years old, I'm 65, but I'm very, very healthy, but I'm still going to self-isolate because even though I'm very healthy and I have no issues or problems, I'm not going to take a chance.
Well, let's expand it out, Doctor. We've got seniors who live for golf and who live for tennis, and they've got regular golfing partners and they got regular tennis partners, and they want to go to their club and they say, oh, it's all very clean and I'm only going to see the caddy and I'm only going to see the bag boy and I'm going to play 18 with my friend who's also very healthy. Do you want them to stay home?
Well, in general, yes. But
perfect.
Again, with exceptions, for example, you don't want people to have crowds that are 10 or more. You don't want to say after you've been one-on-one with someone, you then go to the bar and have a few drinks with 50 people in the bar.
Yep.
Those are the kind of things you don't want to do. But if you want to bend on the side of caution, I would say even though it's relatively low risk to go out and mingle with a few people for now, for the 15-day trial period, I think it's the better part of valor if you are an elderly person to just hunker down for a couple of weeks, see what the trend of the outbreak is.
Now, I'm going to just pause one more time for the 60-plus crowd and especially the 70-plus crowd. Can they go to the market? Can they get their hair cut? Can they go to the pharmacy if they just go and come back?
Well, again, it is some flexibility, but for the most part, it depends on how that person feels. If that person is an otherwise healthy 60-year-old, yes, they can go out to the market. What I would do is do it at a time when the market is not crowded. Do it at a time when there are not a lot of people there. But the default rule would be to self-isolate yourself.
All right, bigger question now, Dr. Fauci.
You are like a character in John Barry's The Great Influenza, like Dr. William Welch, or The Ghost Maps, John Snow and Henry Whitehead. Those are books about the 1918 to 1920 pandemic and the cholera outbreak in London in 1854. I love public health nonfiction history, even though I'm a lawyer. I love this stuff. Are you aware of being a character in a book that will guide future people about how to handle inevitably future pandemics?
You know, I really don't think about it that way. I'm so intensely involved in what we're doing with the task force here and trying to raise the awareness of the American people. I don't think of hardly anything else but the job I'm doing. I'm not thinking ahead about books and characters and things like that.
Well, the reason I want to ask you to do it is because the more we know about what this task force does, the more it will inform the next pandemic. Do you agree with me about that, that we learn from the behaviors of governments in the face of crises, what to do and not to do?
I totally agree with you. In fact, many of the lessons I've learned over the years with attacking the HIV/AIDS epidemic in the early 1980s, the anthrax attacks, the threat of the bird flu, the Ebola, the Zika, all of those things that I've had the experience, I would say the privilege of being able to participate and help in, those have all informed how I do things now.
Is that the president, Dr. Fauci? If it's the president, we can we'll yield.
Well, it isn't the president, but it's
okay.
Close.
Okay, well, I'm not going to yield then. If it's Mike Pence telling me we're talking to you, Hewitt, and Mike will, the vice president will understand. I want to get your advice. You're a good Catholic kid, Our Lady of Guadalupe, Regis High School, as am I. I want your specific advice to the church and other churches. Yeah, that my diocese in Arlington issued a dispensation to 60-year-olds, don't go to Mass. What's your advice to priests over 60, to non-religious pastors of other denominations, kind-hearted people all over, whose natural inclination is to serve their flocks?
Yeah, I think that they should, again, the default, that they should do the guidelines the way we have for others. There are 65-year-olds and 70-year-olds like myself who have jobs that are important in the community and that are service that you have to say, well, for the most part, people in this group should stay home. But some people have jobs that can't do that. So, I mean, I wouldn't make a strict rule for an older priest. I would tell the priest that make sure there's nothing that happens in the Mass, services, the Eucharist, the wine, the host, none of that should endanger people from an infectious disease standpoint. So there are certain things in the Mass, a congregation I might call off if you have people coming together in a church. You know, even individually, it would have to be suspend certain aspects of the Mass. Certainly drinking of wine from the chalice, I would really be careful about.
Now, Doctor, I want to close with you. Senator Cotton's coming up pretty quick, but the big unanswered question, because I don't know that many members of the White House press corps have actually read The Great Influenza, is that between its appearance in Kansas in the spring of 1918 and its devastating second wave, it went through 12 iterations, according to John Barry's book, and the second and third and fourth, they got deadlier. The hardest question for me to answer is during the summer when the virus appears to disappear, will it be iterating into a more deadly virus? Is there any science to tell us if we're getting crowd immunity or if it's going to come back in a more virulent form?
You know, we do not know. When we suppressed the SARS coronavirus, it went away and never came back. We are hoping that if we can suppress this by mitigation and by containment over the next few months, that when we get into the deep summer, that it will disappear. If it doesn't and come back, hopefully that will give us more breathing room to develop therapies as well as a vaccine. But the direct answer to your question is we do not know if it will come back and how it will come back. It's a possibility, but we just need to be prepared for it.
I was cheered yesterday by the record-setting initiation of a trial on a vaccine. I am curious if there is other good news on interventions for those who are suffering from virus pneumonia and related, there are some pretty awful related maladies. Are there any new interventions that have crossed your screen?
Oh, there are several that are in clinical trial. They have not yet been proven to be effective, but there are a number of interventions, what we call therapies, direct antiviral therapies, that are being tested in China and some that are even being tested here in the United States.
Now, my last technical question has to do with the CDC and the testing breakdown. Was that because of regulatory capture? Was that because the CDC always prefers its own work? Was that simply because I think what the president was saying yesterday is, while we've confronted Ebola and H1N1, we've never confronted as fast a moving virus as this one before that is so elusive to diagnose. What happened on the testing development?
You know, it was a complicated series of multiple things that conflated that just, you know, went the wrong way. One of them was a technical glitch that slowed things down in the beginning. Nobody's fault. There wasn't any bad guys there. It just happened. And then when the CDC realized and the FDA, that both the system itself as it was set up, which serves certain circumstances very well, was not well suited to the kind of broad testing that we needed the private sector to get involved in. The regulatory constraints, which under certain circumstances are helpful and protective of the American people, were not suited to the emergence of this particular outbreak. So there was a confluence of a bunch of things. I believe now that the CDC and the FDA and the department, that we've got it right now because we're handing much of it over to the private sector, the heavy hitter companies that do this for a living. And I think what you're going to be seeing looking forward is a major, major improvement in the availability of testing.
Was the glitch or anything about the production of the test President Trump's fault? Or actually, let me put it more broadly, would every president have run into the same problem?
Oh, absolutely. This has nothing to do with anybody's fault, certainly not the president's fault.
And that brings me to my last question. What is it like working with the president? You've worked with a lot of presidents. And by the way, I got two questions. I lied. I have two more questions. What's it like to work with the president?
It's an interesting experience. You know, each president has their own unique character. He's somebody who is, you know, very active, a lot of things going on, very direct, very decisive.
And so my last question is about Tony Fauci. You could have retired years ago and made bank. I mean, you could have gone onto every board of every publicly traded pharmaceutical. You've probably given up $100 million in lost opportunity costs, what economics would call that. Why?
Well, I'm a public servant. I mean, that's who I am. I am who I am, and I've been a public servant for decades and decades. I love it. I love the challenge. And to be quite honest, I mean, that money does not mean that much to me at all. I just need enough to get along and get up and go to work. And what I do, I get a great deal of gratification of. So, I mean, the idea about how many millions and millions and millions I would have, you know, not had, it doesn't faze me. I don't even think about it.
And is that the Catholic in you? Is there a teacher back at Our Lady of Guadalupe? Is there a nun back there who taught Tony Fauci?
Well, there's a nun and there's a bunch of Jesuit priests, too.
Oh, they're Jesuits? Oh, my gosh. I'm not sure. You're making news there if it's the Jesuits. Very last question. The Pope took a walk, Dr. Right. Fauci. What did you make? He's 83 years old. He's out walking around. There's surface infection, right? Is that what the Pope should be doing?
Well, you know, the Pope is a very special person. He has things and responsibilities to his flock, if you want to call it that, that sometimes supersede things of self-protection.
So you're not, well, okay, Tony Fauci, I'm not going to ask you to criticize the Pope. I appreciate your spending time with me, doctor. I think those are great guidelines, and I think you're getting compliance. I lied one more time because Tom Cotton's not here. There were thousands of college kids in the water in Florida yesterday. I'm sure you saw the picture. What's your message to them?
Yeah, I would tell them, please, please, even though you yourself feel invulnerable, being in crowds, getting infected, you may inadvertently bring the infection to a vulnerable person who might be your father, your grandfather, your sick uncle. Take care. We all have to be in this together. This is a, you know, all of country pulling together to get through this.
Should they go home?
The kids, they should just get out of crowds. That's what they should do.
I will leave it at that. I'm going to pass it off to Senator Tom Cotton, Dr. Anthony Fauci. Thank you. You are wonderful.